Last week, Cheryl led us in a song here that was, I suspect, new to most of us. And the lyric opened with this verse. Change is coming. Can't outrun it. Because there's a time when every field lies fallow. There's a time when harvest comes from shadows and only shadows. And it's those first two lines that keep cycling around and around in my head. They're incredibly sticky for me. Change is coming, can't outrun it. Maybe it's because I don't have a lot of problem imagining a fairly sort of primal picture of that. You know, like the idea of outrunning change is a pretty elemental, embodied kind of image. But the other thing that happens to me when I spend time just with that going around and around in my head, which is what it's been doing all week, is because I'm, you know, of a certain vintage, I can't help but hear the voice of Bob Dylan in my head singing, okay, existential sort of question. Does Bob Dylan sing? Anyway. Vocalizing, oh, the times they are a-changing. Now, to be a little more nuanced about the vintage part, I'm not actually old enough to be someone that was like a thoughtfully engaged Dylan fan when he was actually happening. His music, his earlier music especially, feels more like an echo to me than a sound that I hear firsthand in my imagination. So I thought I should look up the lyrics to that little iconic tune, just in case the chorus felt meaningful to me in this context and the verses had nothing to do with it. And he was really talking about his car tire or something, you know. So I thought I should just check, just to be sure. And oh my goodness, like, I don't think I will ever be a fan of Dylan's sonic qualities. They're great fun to imitate in a mocking way, but I was staggered again by the brilliance of his songwriting when I spent some time with the lyrics. I think poet first, you know, might be fair. But anyway, all to say, I was like, we should like hear that tune this morning as part of this. So I looked it up, you know, and then I was like, wait a minute, there's another person in this community who is too young to have grown up with Dylan but should have, and I bet he knows this tune. And I sent Tim a message, and I'm like, Tim, you want to do Dylan this morning? And I quick reply, immediate reply, really. I was like, yes. So we're gonna do Times They Are Changing, and we're gonna do some more Dylan, right? Like we're gonna do Dylan worship. It's all in the inflection. We're gonna do Dylan worship. We're gonna do Dylan. Never mind. We're gonna sing a song. So nobody gets left out in that song, pretty much, right? Like, no wonder so many people were pissed off. Let's just work with verse 1 for right now. Listen up, says the prophet, whose, you know, words ended up written on the subway walls. The waters are rising. Now, these are, in terms of the zeitgeist culturally, these are pre-climate change waters that Dylan is talking about. These are metaphoric waters, not melting sea ice. Although given where sort of I'm headed with this idea, they might turn out to be sort of interchangeable. Short version is that we can admit it or not, we can try to outrun it if we want, but it's happening. And what Dylan says so poetically is that it's time to swim with the tide of change or get ready to drown, because the times they are changing. So this week and next, at least, this might expand, we'll see how it goes. I want to sort of auger into that space a little bit further. I want to get more specific about some of the changes that are coming, some of the changes that are already here, and I want to ask this question, because in this context it feels like an important intersection. I want to ask the question of all of us and of myself, basically, is your God ready for this? It's possible, of course, to just ignore that question. Some of us might shy away from it because of the way I chose to phrase it. What do you mean, your God? Like, isn't there only one true God? Isn't that what it says right in the text? Deuteronomy 6:4, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. More on that later. For now, though, I'm going to stick with the question, is your God ready for the future? For a few decades, I had my own business as a photographer, and the bread and butter work in that industry was then, and in some ways still sort of a niche, was weddings. And so not everybody had a camera in their pocket back then, you know, so you could still actually pay people to do that. So I made some pretty good money doing that, and I loved doing it. I got to be at a lot of weddings, and because at that point in my life, I was also sort of involved in church things, so there was people in some church circles who knew who I was, and a lot of that works by referral. So short version, I ended up at a lot of Christian weddings, and heard lots of, you know, the speech by the parents, welcome to the family speech at the reception. And one of the common refrains in those speeches was something along these lines. We prayed from when you arrived in our family that God would provide just the right person for you, and now here we are celebrating that that's happened. I'm not here this morning to be cynical about either that sentiment or the faith that often underpinned it. To me, there's something very moving about both. But I am here to say that according to the science of our times, who you are attracted to has nothing to do with an intervening God. And so right now, some of you are probably thinking, I knew it! Because on the drive here this morning, you had a blowout with your significant other, and you're thinking, if God gave me this personal love, I don't love God very much right now, and that whole thing's kind of unraveling. Maybe you're thinking that if God's supposed to give me the right person, then God must be napping. There's no right person anywhere on the horizon, and it wouldn't be bad if God woke up and got on with it. Or maybe you've had life experiences that have poked such a big hole in that right person idea that it's just plain not believable anymore at all. And who am I to let the air out of that balloon anyway? Well, it's not me, it's science. So here we go. You might remember that the last few weeks we've been reflecting on compassion and migration, and in those sort of realms we've kept dipping into into the ways in which science is having to do with DNA and what we're learning from old DNA evidence are being serious game changers. And one of the things that those sciences are doing is they're messing with our narratives about all kinds of things. They're messing with our convenient, I understand this way stories. For example, our stories about where we came from as a species have been pretty thoroughly upended in the last 20 years by DNA evidence. The idea of racial superiority has been revealed as sort of scientific nonsense, and that changes a lot of other narratives. Unsettling, perhaps, depending if you were in a place of privilege or not. If you weren't, it's unsettling in a potentially good way, and if you were, it's unsettling in a distressing way. But just wait, because it gets more unsettling than that. So the next part of what I'm going to say is drawn largely from a summary provided by Dr. Bill Sullivan. Sullivan is the professor of pharmacology and microbiology at Indiana School of Medicine. Their specialty is the study of infectious diseases and genetics. I ran across this summary because Sullivan wrote a book called Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. And Sullivan is the person that informed me that my taste in women, his phrase, is not under my control. Now, before I get into serious trouble for even using a phrase like my taste in women, which is arguably objectifying, possibly misogynistic, downright creepy, and it's plural. I didn't know Crean was going to be here this morning. That's all in my notes. You can check later. Give me a moment to unpack it a bit. That's also in my notes. Let's start with something sort of basic. Why am I attracted? I'm going to use myself as an illustration of this because to use anyone else would be just, you know, unkind. Why am I attracted to women rather than men, or to someone that's non-binary or otherwise gender non-conforming? Well, I can't recall any particular moment in my personal story where I had to really wrestle with that. For me, it's always been relatively clear. But when I became aware that it was an open question, I did think about it. And for me, the answer was the same then as it is now. Tim, you're a cisgender man. And if that phrase is unfamiliar to you, cisgender simply means that I identify with the gender I was assigned at birth. So for me, I still resonate with it's a boy when it comes to my gender identity. Now, one of the things that that means for me is that in terms of sexual attraction, I'm drawn to women, not men. Now, we all know that that can be complicated enough, but as I said a moment ago, That's the basic part. Because according to the world of genetics, my sexual orientation is in my DNA. Now, the DNA folks, the science, the people who do this science are quick to say, we can't actually tell you the single isolated gene for this yet. It's a combination of genes. That's sort of the research is at. So we don't have a gene number for this the way we do, for example, for being inclined to risk-taking. There we have an actual single-numbered gene that is the trigger for that kind of inclination. So they'll kind of confess that, but say in this complex, even if it's contentious, if you're somebody who does genetic science, that statement that according to my DNA, my orientation is predetermined. I don't know if this makes you feel yet like it's time to start swimming, but we're going to keep going because the next part, so let's just take that for now, whether it feels like it settles well or doesn't, or we have ways to challenge it because there are ways to challenge it. So let's say Tim, cisgender man, for me, that all kind of falls into place stereotypically. I'm attracted to women. Right. Next part. In the wide world of possible persons that I might be attracted to, why is it this one and not that one? Well, the research says that there's kind of these shared attributes, these things we tend to find attractive. So we tend to find things like shapely mouth, like sparkling eyes, like lush hair. Not my list, you know, but that's what comes out on top. We tend to find those things attractive in other people. And studies show that attractive people are more likely to get a job. They're more likely to make more money. They're more likely to find a mate. They are even more likely to be found not guilty on trial. Pretty powerful stuff, right? Now, that might all seem kind of innate, right? Like it's kind of like, well, yeah, sure, you know, shapely mouth, sparkling eyes, lush hair, yeah, check, check, check. But that still leaves like a lot of fish in the sea. Why this fish, not that fish? If we look at this from the vantage point of evolutionary psychology, we're going to be reminded by those folks that virtually everything that we do is motivated by a subconscious urge to survive and reproduce our genes, or to support those, like family, that carry genes that are like ours. That's kind of like this really deep-seated motivation for us as a species. And evolutionary psychologists would also say that many of the traits that we find attractive in someone else are things that are signs of physical health and fitness. So in other words, we're basically looking for good genes to let swim in our pool. That's kind of what's going on at the base of that. So who we're attracted to is actually anchored in genetics, not in the more common idea that it's personal taste or something else that we think of as under our control. So why are the people that I might be attracted to not necessarily attracted to me? Maybe the rest of you have never had this experience. Okay, so I'm not going to tell any personal stories. I'm just going to take it as given that not everyone would be attracted to me just because I'm attracted to them. Well, from a genetic studies point of view, this one's a beauty. There's this really famous study where a bunch of women were given smelly t-shirts to sniff. Science. This might have been paid for with funding from my taxes. Anyway, so these women sat around and they sniffed the underarms of these t-shirts, and then, no pun intended, they ranked them in order of, not bad, huh? They can't all be funny, but I thought that was pretty good. They ranked them in order of kind of more to less, you know, smelly. So which ones they found most distasteful and so on. Well, here's the thing that's interesting about this. It turns out that the more similar the men's and women's immune system genes were, the worse the t-shirt smelled to the women. So, here's the evolutionary explanation. If parental immune genes are too similar, the offspring won't be as well equipped to fight pathogens. So in this case, what's happening is the genes are using odor receptors as a proxy to size up whether or not a potential mate's genes are a good match. So, it turns out I like the way you smell is not personal taste after all. Now, that might seem a little bit disempowering, but on the plus side, it could also mean that rejection isn't personal. It's more like organ donation being rejected, right? It's genetic. It's a genetic reason that this person doesn't like me. How's that for a great side door for rejection, right? DNA, you know. We don't even have to call them an idiot. It's just DNA. And as it turns out, that kind of science is easily applied to a bunch of other things that we might think or even maybe have been sort of punished for having not responded to appropriately. For example, I won't unpack this one, but for instance, the reason that some people hate broccoli is actually genetic. There's actually this is an isolated gene, there's actually an isolated gene that gives some of us as humans a hyper-attenuated taste sensor for certain kinds of acids that are present uniquely in broccoli. And broccoli does not taste to those of us who have that gene like it tastes to the rest of humanity. We hate it, and we arrived that way.
Cilantro is the same way.
Yeah. See, cilantro is a polarizing vegetable.
Some of it, like people like me, it tastes like soap, greasy,
soapy poison. Metal, and so on. Yeah, right. See? So. I think there's a, before we get stuck here, but that hit the nerve. I can talk about sexual attraction for like 10 minutes and nobody even lights up. I talk about broccoli and the whole room goes off. I debated which illustration to use. Like, clearly I chose wrong. Anyway, so it's pretty interesting though, isn't it? Like, I think there's a, if I remember this correctly, there's a frenemy character in Seinfeld who says at some point that they wouldn't eat broccoli if it was like dipped in chocolate and deep fried, like, right? Something like that. So anyway, like there's some of us just like, and that's DNA, that's genetic. Now, if we get into this stuff a little deeper, it can really start to feel like we're kind of just meat puppets, you know, like the genetic predeterminism kind of tells the whole story about who we are and what we prefer and what we don't. And that's that. We're just kind of, you know, pawns in the genetic game. The good news is that DNA has also built us a pretty great brain. Has some limitations. We're going to come to some of that next week. But one of the upshots of that is that we can sort of figure out DNA's game and we can work with it. One of the things that we've learned in that process is how to edit and splice genes. That's a whole nother thing, okay? Man, you want to get into an ethical conundrum that doesn't seem to have a bottom. Let's just talk about prenatal gene splicing for a little while. Anyway, but for now, what does all of that, because we just took a bunch of time with this, what does that have to do with what we believe? And more specifically, what does that have to do with what we believe about the divine, about God? Well, for me, God made me this way just turned into even more of a bumper sticker than it was already. Like, talk about an idea that is way past shorthand and into meaninglessness when you start to look at life through this lens. In fact, it's often the case that the further we wade into this kind of information, the more many of the most common conceptions of God start to look like either superstition or just plain wishful thinking of the my imaginary friend variety. And for sure, this is a realm of science that seriously messes with the interventionist ideas that are running in the not very distant background of the parents who say something at the wedding like, we prayed, God acted, here we are. And for lots and lots of people, this is a rising tide of change that has just swept away any possibility of something for which we would use a word like faith. It's easy when you spend some time with this stuff. It's easy, I think, it's easy to understand the draw of the so-called new atheists, folks probably most prominently represented by people like Sam Harris, the author of The End of Faith, Christopher Hitchens, author of God Is Not Great, Richard Dawkins, who gave us the God delusion. And I realize that the thinking of Harris and Hitchens and Dawkins is not uniform, but they do have some things in common that bear on what we're examining here. And one of them is that this is a group of thinkers that make the claim that there is no proof that God exists, and in light of that, belief in God is naive, and it's delusional, and it has resulted in great evil. So that's sort of a shared group of claims that they all make. And these are smart people. And the appeal of much of what they argue for, I think, isn't really that hard to appreciate. Now, I'm not here this morning to take these guys on. For lots of people, the deconstruction of their faith has led them quite directly to some of the ideas these authors espouse, and that's become a meaningful path for them. They don't all say the same things, of course, but what they have in common, I think, is important to our exploration. When Harris, Hitchens, and Dawkins in particular say that belief in God is naive and delusional, they are quite uniformly all attacking the most common understanding of the word God in Western culture. They're not writing as theologians, and they don't tend to nuance that very much. They tend to work with the prevailing idea. Of course, that's what makes sense in their context. The most common understanding of the word God in Western culture is that it refers to a person-like being, a sort of a super powerful authority figure that created the universe a long time ago, that operates outside of it, and that occasionally intervenes. Is that a familiar-sounding picture? Theologian Marcus Borg calls this picture of God supernatural theism. I'm not referring to theological terminology, but that's an interesting label for that, supernatural theism. And Borg, who's a Christian theologian, has a lovely collection of essays called Days of Awe and Wonder, How to Be a Christian in the 21st Century. That's quite interesting. Borg agrees with Harris and company. There's a Christian theologian saying of their dismissal of this God idea, yeah, I don't find that idea especially believable either, and I don't believe it. So if that's who God is, I'm with you. That's naive and dangerous and results in great evil. Interesting, eh? However, it's a common enough understanding that it's easy to think that it's the only one that exists. It's a common enough understanding in our shared experience in a relatively small group of people like this that it's easy to think that it's the only thing that the word God could mean. It's probably the basic understanding of God that most of us have experienced. But if we actually were to pay attention outside of the idea about God that has the most kind of cultural currency in our experience, we would pretty quickly discover that there's another idea about what that word means that is just as old, has had just as much traction at some points in history, but isn't the one that kind of won the institutional idea battle for which idea about God are we going to propagate. And that idea is the concept that doesn't think of God as a person-like being separate from the universe, but rather as a spiritual reality that interpenetrates the universe. It's a fair bit in that sense. We might say that in that kind of a conception of God, we're imagining, and again, language sort of fails in all of this, doesn't it? But we're imagining an encompassing spirit in which everything that is lives. To put that into a particularly compact biblical text, it's the words that are attributed to Paul that describe the divine as the one in whom we live and move and have our being. I know that in my experience with that text, it was pretty easy to stop at the idea of one as the superperson. But actually living and moving and having my being in that idea of one doesn't work at all. I have to get past that. I have to get to the whole sentence, right? And if we want to consider the history of the idea, if the historicity of ideas is important to us, if we believe that one of the ways that we can measure the veracity of something in human experience is by its durability, for example, why do we keep playing those Beatles songs? Anyway, like to use a contemporary example, why do some things seem to have a sturdiness about them, the ability to travel through change and still have some kind of an intact core? If that kind of an idea feels important to us in assessing the merit of an idea, then with this concept about the divine being an encompassing spirit in which everything that is lives, we could back up to as early a Christian theologian as Irenaeus, writing around the year 200, so this is pretty fresh in terms of Christian thought, who said, God contains everything and nothing contains God. Now, if you like fancy theological terms, and I know there are some of you here, I won't call you out, that idea theologians call pananentheism. So not pantheism, pananentheism. All the parts are important. I'm not going to break it down. And it's terrain that the mystics have occupied going back as far as we can tell. The idea that all the things we experience happen inside of some context for which we may choose to use God language. That's a really old idea. Now, here's the thing that's curious to me about that. In my imagination, that's a kind of an idea about the divine in which Harris and Hitchings and Dawkins can all do their work. And I can access their work and the good thinking that is in their work without abandoning my God concept. Because my God concept is not the size of the present. My God concept is not the size of the future. All of those things fit within that concept, happen within that concept. It's bigger than God is like me, but, you know, on steroids. It's an interesting idea. We're going to leave it there for right now. We're going to pick it up against next week. But what I want to do is just leave us with one more thought about that verse in Deuteronomy that we started with. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. So that's an old text. It's got an old idea in it. The Hebrew word that is used in that Deuteronomy text for one is the word echad. The word echad means... Why didn't anybody tell me this, you know, when I was an undergrad? Because they knew it blew the ship out of the water. The word echad means unity, not singularity. There is a Hebrew word for singularity. It's yachid, not echad. So, when the Hebrew thinkers are trying to define the divine, when the ancients are trying to define the divine, and remember, this is the group of people who gave us, most predominantly as a Western society, the idea of God as one, as a monotheism, they wrote that God is one. God is unity, not singularity. Same word, by the way, that's used in the text that says that husband and wife become one. Obviously, they don't cease to be individual, but they're unified. Same word. Interesting, eh? The Hebrew word for absolute singularity, yachid, is never, ever used in the Hebrew scriptures in reference to God. I think that's super interesting. If we wanted to think about it in a less mystical way than even the union of partners, which is definitely a mystic thing, in my opinion, we could think of this word echad as describing a forest being one, as distinct from a tree being one. So, if we needed more permission textually, for whatever reason, to imagine that there might be a way to think about the divine that is an expanding way to think rather than a contracting way to think, that is a way that contains the possibility of everything that we make and experience as human beings fitting within that conception, including ideas that there is no personal being that we should call God. It's an old idea. It's an old idea that is rich in the tradition on which the Christian tradition stands. But it's one that tradition, the Christian tradition, didn't particularly pick up. I don't think it served it very well. So it didn't get picked up. But it's there, all the way through. And there have always been voices referencing it and pointing us back to it. So, anyway, next week. Next week, what I want to do is, we'll see how this works when I actually try to put it into a talky bit. But I want to talk about a writer who's got a lot of currency these days, who makes a proposal in their most recent book about the final religion of humanity and what they think that might be. And so that's where we're headed. All right. Peace.